The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. So this morning, I was trying to think about what I'd like to talk about, and I remembered a couple of analogies, and one of them, I think it might have come up last week or the week before around the simile of the raft. So that's one of the analogies I'd like to talk about. And there's two analogies the Buddha used, probably more, around thinking of the practice as crossing a flood. And so I'd like to look at those two analogies together today. The Buddha actually was a master at metaphor and analogy. They're so apt and often can be quite an interesting place for reflection to think about the analogies that he offers in terms of the practice. So that's what I'd like to do today. So the first one, the simile of the raft. Actually, I'll read it to you. Or I'll read it in parts anyway. He says, "I shall show you how the Dhamma is similar to a raft, for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping. Suppose a man, in the course of a journey, saw a great expanse of water, whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose further shore was safe and free from fear. But there was no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore." So here, you know, the analogies, he often has the analogies, each piece of the analogy means something. So in this case, the near shore refers to our life as it is, with the confusion, the suffering, all of the difficulties that we deal with. And the far shore refers to freedom from suffering, to nibbana. And the flood or the great stream refers to what we have to do to move from one shore to another. And the flood also in very many places with the stream, the great expanse of water, refers to the ways that we are caught. It refers to the flood of greed, of aversion, of delusion. So continuing. "Then this man thought, there is a great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful and whose further shore is safe and free from fear, but there's no ferry boat or bridge going to the far shore. Suppose I collect grass, twigs, branches, and leaves, and bind them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore." So he had the intention, the thought of doing this. And then he goes on to say, and then he collected the grass, twigs, branches, leaves, bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft, and making an effort with his hands and feet, got safely across to the far shore. So I want to explore this part of the analogy. So the stream or the flood representing the ways in which in which our lives are kind of flooded by greed, aversion, delusion, craving. And the part of this teaching is talking about the possibility of there being a way to cross that, to being a way to navigate our lives in a skillful way. So there's a bunch of different pieces here, and I'm just going to kind of try to pull the pieces together. So one of the pieces is that he talks about building the raft out of grass, twigs, branches, leaves, and bind them together into a raft. So here he is on this side of the river, and he just uses what's around him to build this raft. He doesn't go off in search of a lumberyard to find really good quality wood to make this raft. He uses what's in the immediate environment. And I think this is actually a key piece of the teaching, that we use what is in our immediate present moment experience as the raft. Our sights, our sounds, our smells, our tastes, our touches, and anything arising in the mind. This is the material that we start to build the raft out of. And in a way, the binding together into a raft, you know, this is not described in the descriptions of the analogy, I don't believe, but, you know, there's different ways to bind those experiences together. We can bind them together out of greed, aversion, and delusion. You know, the experience of a sight, we can hate the sight and we can start thinking about it and get frustrated by it. Or we can meet it with mindfulness. We can meet it with kindness. We can meet it with compassion. We can meet it with the skill of the Dharma. And so I think about this analogy as being, you know, gathering the experience of our moment together with the binding of the Dharma. And that binding of the Dharma, the practices, the tools of the Dharma, support us to be able to use our experience to float across the flood of greed, aversion, and delusion. So we use our everyday moment-to-moment experience as the path. And it is the path when we can meet it with mindfulness. Actually, with the factors of the Eightfold Path. With wise thought, wise intention, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise mindfulness, wise effort, and wise concentration. Those are the parts that allow us to use our moment-to-moment experience to, instead of being sunk into it and swept away by the way our minds usually work, by grasping onto things that we like and wanting to have more of them, or hating things we don't like, wanting to push them away. Instead, we can use these things that we like and that we don't like as the grass, the leaves, the twigs, the branches that are used to cross the stream. The only way to move from a state of suffering to a state of non-suffering is to use the experience of the present moment. We can't think our way out of it. We really have to meet our experience of the moment. So in a sense, you know, we have to use the flood or the stream in order to cross the stream. But there's not a separation. I mean, we seem to think somehow that, you know, when we start practicing or meditating, it will take us into some other realm. But what it really does is takes us deeply into this realm and shows us how we react in this realm that creates our suffering in this realm. So it's very much a contacting our experience, meeting our experience, being willing to turn towards and meet our experience that allows us to move across, to move across the flood. So this raft is built out of our moment-to-moment experience plus wise intention, wise thought, wise speech, wise action, wise livelihood, wise mindfulness, wise effort, wise concentration. And then before I go on to what the final part of this analogy is, I'd like to bring in the other analogy that I wanted to explore, which is the Buddha was talking to somebody who asked him, "So how did you cross the flood?" And again, there's this image of water, rushing water, essentially, or a large expanse of water that's difficult to get across. And the Buddha responded, "By neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood." And the person, I think it was a deva, kind of a celestial being that was talking to the Buddha, and said, "But how did you, by neither tarrying nor hurrying, cross the flood?" And the Buddha said, "Well, when I tarried, I sank. When I hurried, I was swept away. So by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood." Now, I like this. I mean, I find this inspiring personally. I mean, in the first place, the Buddha says, "When I tarried, I sank." I mean, he didn't do it perfectly, right? I mean, he found, what he did was explore what happens to me as I'm trying to navigate this terrain. When I tarry, I sink. When I hurry, I get swept away. So what does that mean? What does it mean to tarry, and what does it mean to sink? There's a lot of different ways to think about this, and I'll just offer you a few that I have reflected on and thought about. Tarrying can mean, you know, if you think about what it might mean to tarry with your experience, you've got some experience that's coming up. And tarrying with it might mean trying to hold on to it, trying to keep it, or trying to do something with it, meeting it with some kind of greed or aversion, just not able to just let the moment arise and pass away, but some kind of holding on to it. That's like a kind of clinging, is a kind of a tarrying. When we experience is kind of in a flow. It's in a flow. A stream, you know. It's actually, the analogy of a stream of water is very apt for what our experience does. It flows through us. There's this continual stream of sight, sound, smells, tastes, touches, and things arising in our mind. It's just never ending. But we don't often relate to our experience as this never ending stream. We try to hold on to particular configurations because we like them. Or we don't like particular configurations and we try to get rid of them. So we tarry with various configurations of experience, trying to manipulate them, to change them, to fix them, to control them. And in that we sink. We kind of drown in our experience. And we drown in the suffering that's created around the craving, the clinging, that comes with that tarrying. The hurrying, one way to think about the hurrying is kind of having a sense of expectation about the future, or moving into the future, trying to construct what you'd like the future to be. So hurrying into your future experience, hurrying into not meeting the flow as it is, but thinking ahead and trying to manipulate how things might become. Kind of a hurrying. We get swept away by our thoughts. That's another way to think about the swept away, that, you know, the experience of the mind kind of propelling into the future, creating all kinds of thoughts. It is a sense of getting swept into something that doesn't actually exist yet. So that that hurrying, kind of having an, you know, if you think about hurrying too, hurrying to get across to some other place. Again, it's like it's having an expectation of, how do I get there? How can I get there?
what can I do to get there? And we get lost. We lose our kind of our footing, our secure, stable, moment-to-moment experience by thinking about how we can get there. So we get swept away. Another way of thinking of tarrying is, the hindrance of sloth and torpor, of sleepiness, of dullness, of just not connecting with experience. In that kind of sleepiness and dullness, we sink into oblivion. And another way to think about the hurrying is with a restless mind, a mind that can't really land on anything. It's just jumping from thing to thing to thing. And it feels like it's not stable, and it's kind of a swept away experience to have the mind being restless. So when I tarried, I sank. When I hurried, I was swept away. So by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood. So for me, this really points to the moment-to-moment meeting of this flow of experience. And I have used this image for myself in my own meditation practice, kind of just this kind of just stable, you know, just keep going. Don't hold on to what was just there, and don't kind of rush into the next thing. Meet each thing, but don't hold on to it. Very powerful image of just meeting moment by moment our experience. So I like, you know, the way these two analogies come together. Because the image of the raft kind of sounds like we make the raft and then we move across the stream. But actually what really has to happen is that as we're crossing the stream, we're building the raft out of the stream. So that, that's that kind of neither tarrying nor hurrying as we're crossing the stream on that raft. The other part about this raft analogy is, I'll just read you this next part. And so the man collected grass, twigs, branches, and leaves and bound them together into a raft, and supported by the raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then when he had got across and had arrived at the far shore, he might think thus, "This raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head, or load it on my shoulder, and then go wherever I want." And then the Buddha says, "Now what do you think? By doing that, would the man be doing with what should be done with that raft?" And, of course, the answer is no. That the raft is used to cross the flood. And I think what the Buddha is pointing to here, I mean, he goes on to explicitly say, that a skillful response to the raft would be, "So I have made it safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to haul the raft onto dry land or to set it adrift in the water and then go wherever I want." And he says, "So I have shown you how the Dhamma is similar to the raft for the purposes of crossing over, not for the purposes of grasping." And so, you know, this raft is what has supported us to move across this flood. And at some point, we have to let go of the raft. It's not helpful to hold on to with an idea. I mean, the grasping around this, the raft is kind of carrying it around on your head. It's like, I'm a Buddhist, or, you know, I know the right way, that kind of thing. So the letting go of the raft is a pointing to the fact that we have to ultimately let go of everything. But I'm going to back up a second, because sometimes in hearing the teachings about letting go, the teachings about, you know, not clinging, we find as we practice that we're clinging to the practice. We are clinging to mindfulness. We cling to peace of mind. We want those things. And we hear about the teaching of non-clinging. We think, well, I'm not supposed to want peace of mind. And it's true that ultimately a clinging to that will cause us suffering. You can't let go of it too soon. You need to hold on to the raft while you're crossing the stream. So in a way, you know, there's this a kind of way that the clinging and the holding on to the Dharma for a period of time is actually skillful. And some people say, well, it's not so much really clinging to the Dharma. And it's, I mean, any kind of clinging will cause suffering. And so even clinging to the Dharma will cause suffering at some point. It's making use of the Dharma. And yet the Buddha actually did mention that there is a kind of craving that can be used to overcome craving. I think I mentioned this analogy too not long ago, that the craving that leads to further greed, aversion, and delusion is not skillful. And there is a kind of a craving that, you know, kind of a craving for freedom, a craving for peace of mind, that supports us for a time. And then at some point, even that craving needs to be released. So the final part of this section of this teaching is that the Buddha says, when you know the Dhamma to be similar to a raft, you should abandon even good states. How much more so even bad states? By good states, he means states of generosity, of kindness, of compassion, of mindfulness, of energy, of concentration. By abandoning them, he doesn't mean pushing them aside. He means not holding to them, not clinging to them, not having to have them. So again, you know, this is a kind of a subtle navigation of our mind states. And the way I navigate this in my own experience is to look at the suffering. So, you know, in my early retreats, it was pretty clear that I was creating a new identity as a meditator. And I could see that I was doing that, you know, that I was kind of, I'm a good meditator and, you know, I'm going to do this. And I could see that was happening. And I could see also that it was kind of helping me to let go of less skillful identities, such as I'm a miserable person, I'm a bad person, I hate myself, those kinds of identities. So it was supportive as a way to begin to cross some of those more unskillful states of mind. And I kind of knew at some point, I told myself, yeah, I'm creating this identity as a meditator, I'm probably going to have to let this go at some point. But it served me for a very long time. And it still serves me at times. On retreat, particularly these days, I notice there are times when the agenda to be mindful, the wanting to be mindful, the trying to be mindful, creates a lot of suffering. And I have to let go of that agenda. I have to notice the agenda. It's not that the mindfulness disappears, but the kind of holding to it is what lets go. We have this belief, in a way, that if I'm not holding to something, that it's going to go away. You know, and sometimes it arises and passes away. All things arise and pass away. Mindfulness arises and passes away. We can notice when it's present. When it's gone, we don't notice much. We notice it comes back. The holding to it can start to create a sense of struggle and stress. And that when it gets to that point, it's time to start letting go of that agenda. But it's if you let go of that agenda too soon and say, well, obviously I'm not supposed to want to be mindful, so I won't try to be mindful, you'll never get anywhere. So you have to build the raft. You have to build that raft using the tools of the Dharma. And then learn how, over time, aspects of it we need to release, need to let go of. Using, at least in my own experience, using suffering as the kind of guide. You know, there was a subtle kind of suffering, I think, to that initial, you know, creating of a new identity as a meditator. There was a subtle kind of suffering to that. But it was much subtler than the suffering of the identity of hating myself. And it supported the letting go of that identity. It's kind of like, you know, just kind of elaborating on this as an analogy, it's kind of like, you know, as we build rafts, we build various kinds of rafts that support our being able to let go of less skillful rafts. And then as we keep crossing, we're continuing to build a new raft. And at some point, it's like, okay, this identity need to build perhaps a subtler raft, a subtler support for letting go of that identity. So it's a process. And we can't just simply say, okay, I'm not going to cling. Just not going to do that. And if we just try to assume that the teaching of non-clinging means that there isn't a path or there isn't a kind of a way to navigate, then we'll never make the effort that needs to be made to actually cross the stream. It's kind of a paradox. It feels like a kind of a paradox that when, you know, if it feels like you have a choice about being mindful or not, choose mindfulness. Even though, you know, there isn't really anybody there to choose. You know, if it feels like there's someone there to choose, choose. Choose mindfully. Choose skillfully. And that, I think it's really the brilliance of the Buddha to realize there were ways of navigating. You know, it's kind of like what we're doing is creating more skillful selves to be able to let go of less skillful selves. And that there is a way, you know, that this pointing towards letting go of greed, aversion, and delusion, being mindful, bringing our attention to experience, noticing when things are skillful and unskillful, this is a direction that takes us stage by stage across the flood. And it is a staged kind of thing. We can't let go of it all at once. And then the last piece that I'll say is the understanding, or one of the understandings, and I looked for the reference. I can't find the reference. I was kind of putting this talk together last night, kind of late, and I couldn't find the reference I was looking for. But there's a reference around someone who is fully awake, that they are essentially naturally living the Eightfold Path. Now, they don't have to try to do it. It is just who they are. So there's no clinging to it. It is just the manifestation of their expression of awakening. So that the kind of identity around having to do, needing to do, needing to choose is not necessary, because the awakened mind in meeting experience, it is said, will choose skillfully. It's not something that one has to do. It is just something that happens because wisdom is present. So there's just simply that natural living of the Eightfold Path. And I think this is really, this is an important aspect to reflect on, because, you know, sometimes there are teachings, kind of paradoxical or confusing teachings around virtue. You know, it's like in some of the Buddhist schools, there's this notion that you transcend virtue when you're fully enlightened. And that transcending of virtue doesn't mean that virtue doesn't apply to you. It means that you don't have to think about it. You naturally behave compassionately, kindly, skillfully. It's not an effort to do that. There's actually some lists in the teachings around what somebody who's fully awakened cannot possibly do. You know, they can't possibly lie. They can't possibly kill their parents. Things like this. So that. The movement towards awakening, it can be a guide for us in a way, you know, in looking at how people behave. You know, the ethical conduct is a great guideline, or a great indicator in a way of how awake we are. And if, you know, we think, if we have some idea, oh yes, I've got a certain level of attainment. If we see ourselves lying, it's like, well, okay. Maybe I have some work to do. So I like this fact, actually, that the Buddha really points back to, the ethical conduct is the ground out of which our practice grows. And it doesn't get left behind. It gets left behind in terms of the effort needed. But the expression of someone who is awakened as a fully realized being is living in the world in a very ethical way. And I find that inspiring, that it's such an integral part of the entire fabric of the teaching. So those are my thoughts on those two analogies. Are there any thoughts that you have, or comments, or questions? It doesn't have to be about the analogies. It can be about anything. Your practice.
So I'm interested in this idea of letting go of mindfulness. And I can feel sometimes just being mindfulness driven, like you just keep being mindful and mindful and mindful and mindful of, and nothing changes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, or it changes, but then it goes back to a certain mind state or a certain feeling, more of a feeling.
So is there a kind of a feeling of an agenda towards mindfulness? I'm going to be mindful.
So I can get rid of this feeling.
So you can get rid of the feeling, yeah.
Right.
That's a key.
And then letting go of that, and then something does change. There's some, you know, just more of a global awareness, but then the feeling creeps back in. And
right, yeah.
So
you know, there's a couple pieces here. One is the, you know, the kind of agenda. You know, as we learn about mindfulness, this is so common that we begin to see, oh, when I'm mindful of difficulties, they feel easier. You know, it's like, you know, when we first stumble into this, it's like, yeah, you know, when I'm mindful of things get a lot easier. It feels a lot lighter. And so then we start being mindful in order to feel better. And that actually kind of undercuts the whole way things work, because essentially then we are motivated out of either greed or aversion to be mindful. And that is, in our mindfulness itself, it is reinforcing greed or aversion. So we need to, in our attention to things and in our attention to experience, we need to from time to time check in. And how am I paying attention to this thing? So is there an agenda? You know, I'm paying attention to some difficult emotion. Is there an agenda that it will go away if I pay attention, like a bargain? I'll pay attention to you if you'll go away. So that agenda then needs to be, and it's not that we actually have to say, oh, bad agenda, get rid of that agenda. That's more aversion. You know, aversion to that agenda. So we have to recognize, oh, that agenda is operating, and open up to, okay, what does it feel like to want that thing to go away? And what does it feel like to have that kind of agenda? So that's one aspect of what you were referring to. You know, another aspect can be that we, you know, kind of just have this idea of mindfulness as being a good thing to do, and we kind of are greedy about mindfulness, like I need to be mindful, as opposed to really just meeting experience as it is. There's kind of a heaviness or a kind of a, like we've picked up mindfulness as a backpack and we're carrying it around with us, and it's a doing as opposed to just a more natural kind of experience. And now saying that, you know, as I said, we do have to do. I mean, we can't just say, oh, well, okay, I want to do mindfulness, therefore I have to forget about it, you know, not do it. So there's this interesting kind of balancing act we have to navigate with it. So one of the ways I navigate with this, the balancing act around the doing of mindfulness, is, again, looking at suffering. So noticing when that efforting to be mindful is creating stress and suffering. If it's simply, you know, if it's not experienced as stress or suffering, which it might not be if you're dealing with something very challenging. I mean, if there's some difficult state that you're paying attention to and you're bringing mindfulness to it and trying to bring mindfulness to it, and it's creating a sense of space, you're getting a sense of ease around the difficulty. You know, that effort towards mindfulness is creating more of that lightness. Again, it's kind of the identity with mindfulness, the identity of paying attention, which supports the beginning to let go of that more challenging identity. But at times it will kind of feel like we get into this habit of doing mindfulness, and it feels way overstressed. We sit down and meditate and we get a headache because we're trying so hard to be mindful. So one of the ways I play with this is to ask myself the question, when I notice that I'm over-efforting, when I notice that I'm trying too hard to do the mindfulness, is I'll ask myself the question, okay, can I not try so hard? Or how little effort do I need to actually be aware here? and let go of the efforting, you know, just noticing that the efforting is happening. I mean, this is, again, turning, it's kind of like turning mindfulness towards the efforting. And so notice that that efforting is happening, letting go of that kind of pushing into experience. And I find, much to my surprise, often I can really let go a lot. That mindfulness often has its own momentum that doesn't need quite so much pushing, and that I can simply ride on the momentum of the mindfulness that is there. And that will last for so long, and then the mindfulness, you know, will get lost in thought. And I'll know, okay, need a little bit more effort to kind of stay connected. So there is the kind of playing with the level of effort around the mindfulness and letting go. And then there's the thing you brought in about patterns coming back, you know, that you pay attention for a while, you notice that there's an agenda perhaps, and in noticing that agenda, things maybe shift a little bit. But then hours later, minutes later, that same pattern can just come back. Well, these patterns are... they are the grist for the mill. You know, they are well practiced, these habits. You know, particularly ones that you find coming back a lot, they tend to be the ones that we've practiced a lot. And so to think that a few moments of bringing mindfulness to a pattern will banish it forever is to not really kind of understand the whole momentum of those habits. There's a lot of momentum that those habits of mind have, patterns that we have. There's an incredible amount of momentum. And we can meet it with mindfulness for a time. And then when mindfulness kind of dissipates, or that, you know, we're in a place where things seem fine and we're not quite so attentive, the patterns can just resurface. And it can often take a long time, you know, of meeting a pattern over and over and over and over and over and over and over before it kind of begins to fall apart. And I've seen different ways that they fall apart, you know, that... But mostly it takes being willing... The different ways I've seen them fall apart have been because I've been willing to not be judgmental and aversive that the pattern keeps coming back. That I actually, to some extent welcome with the interest in understanding this pattern. Not to get rid of it, but to simply understand. So that if the agenda can shift in mindfulness from wanting to get rid of to wanting to understand, that's a subtler kind of wanting, in effect. And I have seen the wanting to understand be suffering, too. So we can, you know, all of these wantings will get in the way. But again, a subtler kind of wanting, you know. Can I understand this pattern? Can I be interested in this pattern? When I have been willing to just meet a pattern that way, without the judgment, without the aversion, over time, the pattern, because, you know, patterns like that tend to be based in greed, aversion, and delusion, and they are, they have a certain momentum, a certain life, a certain amount of greed, aversion, and delusion that has been propelling them, and if we can just meet each time those come up, with mindfulness and without reinforcing the pattern of aversion or without reinforcing the pattern of judgment, slowly those patterns seem to lose the momentum of the greed, aversion, and delusion that's behind them. They slowly seem to lose that momentum. And in my experience, much of my own practice has been kind of watching a gradual wearing away of those patterns. There's another analogy that I really love about a shipwreck. The Buddha talks about our paying attention to our experience being like the way the sun and the sand and the waves and the wind rot the carcass of the ship. The shipwreck is, on the beach, and there's the rope hanging there and the wood and all these various pieces. And over the months, the sun and the sand and the wind gradually wear away at those bits and pieces. You know, each day you look at a particular bit of rope, it looks like it's the same rope as yesterday. And keep looking at it. One day you go to pick up that rope and it just falls apart in your hand. So in my own experience, that's been the way a lot of my patterns have dismantled. It's been a slow wearing away. And in fact, in that analogy, the other part I like about that analogy is that you've got that rope sitting there. The rope's just sitting there. It looks like a rope, You're never going to know actually when the final fiber separates so that it'll disintegrate. And in my own experience, I have also seen that, we think with particular patterns that the work is in the meeting it, and that it will be that we meet the thing and it'll disappear, as we're meeting it somehow. Mostly, actually, in some of my patterns, what I've seen is that they keep coming up, and I look at them, I notice them, hang out with them. Or if they're too strong, I put them aside. I meet them. Okay, I see you, and you're a little stronger than my mindfulness, so I'm going to pay attention to something else right now, and just you do your thing. I'm going to just turn my attention here. So without aversion, turning away from. And in that process, beginning to recognize over months that the pattern, that particular pattern, is not coming up as frequently. And so starting to see that kind of wearing away through just the less frequency of arrival of that pattern. It still felt as strong each time it came up, but it wasn't coming up as often. At first it would be like, every day I'd have this thought of this person and the anger around this person. And then it started settling, and every couple of weeks I'd remember, oh, I'm so angry. Oh, there's the anger. Okay, see you. Put it aside. And then at some point I was walking, up to my door, and I thought, wow, I haven't felt that anger in a long time. And I couldn't even conjure it up, thinking about the person that I had been angry at. And I thought, wow, is it gone? Kind of like checking. Where did it go? And I didn't actually trust that it was actually gone. But it never came back, that anger. In fact, that particular relationship slowly over time shifted and morphed into one where I just really wish that person to be happy. Whereas before, every time that person came up in my mind, it was like inseparable. It's like I could not imagine that person coming up in my mind without anger coming up in my mind. And the disappearance of that link between that image of that person and the anger, kind of the tight coupling of that. I know all of you have a sense of this, that there's some memory or some thought that comes up, and it's so tightly coupled with some emotion that it seems like there's no way that they can be separate. Well, for me, that separation of those two happened when I didn't see it. It happened somehow in the background. I didn't have to meet that anger and really, look at it and watch it suddenly, boom, disappear in a flash and never again to arise. It was a simple being willing over and over again to just meet that experience without judgment, without fear, without aversion, and kind of like slowly rotted away. So, but the key, and I've had other experiences where it has seemed like a knife coming down in the midst of, you know, looking at self-hatred. It's like, oh, boom, seeing it as just an arising thought. And it's just like, wow, this is just a thought. And poof, the whole pattern just poof, disappears. That can sometimes happen, that kind of really rapid, like a knife cutting the thread. But it's my experience is much more this slow, gentle wearing away. And the willingness to, in both cases, you know, whether it's a knife cutting down to say, or the slow, gentle wearing away, in both cases it took that willingness to meet the pattern without judgment. And if you can't meet it without judgment, to be willing to meet the judgment without judgment. So back, you know, keep backing up. And where can you meet this with a balanced mind? Where can you meet this? I don't like this. Okay, not liking. Can I know that I don't like this? Oh yeah. For some reason for me, not liking is one that I finally, oh yeah, I don't like this. Okay. No big deal. I can be with not liking. So, there are just some thoughts on that side.
One thing I found helpful recently, I heard someone describe dukkha as not just stress, but stress and joy, mm-hmm. sorrow and joy, and to pay attention to the joy part.
Absolutely. And that, again, that's pointing to the subtler kinds of clinging. You know, that initially, as we engage in the practice, it begins to, you know, it's like, wow, I can make this shift. And there's a lot of joy that comes up. You know, it's like, there's still this pattern of whatever it is, you know, frustration or you know, self-aggrandizement or whatever it is. There's still that pattern, but I can see it. And there's a sense of joy of being able to meet that. And at some point, we have to turn to notice the joy, too, is a mental formation that does create stress. There's one time on a retreat, I was...
I didn't mean that. I meant just the joy of presence.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah. And that's true. I mean, you do have to notice. Basically, we have to notice everything. You know, that. But let me just, you know, point to one other piece, because this is another piece that a lot of people kind of miss in their exploration. You know, in the observing of an experience, I began noticing, you know, oh, there's that pattern again. You know, oh, look at the mind doing that again. And there was kind of a sense of amusement. I'm like, oh, yeah, you know, that's pretty cute the way the mind does that all the time. And then I realized that I hadn't been noticing the amusement. And when I brought that piece in to actually recognize the amusement, it's like both the amusement, when I turned and recognized amusement, both the amusement and the thing that I was amused about vanished instantly. And I was just left in a very neutral space, a kind of equanimous space. And so the joy of practice, essentially, the joy of presence, the joy of engaging, we do have to turn to that as well at some point. But again, you know, using a little bit the guideline around stress. I mean, it is the joy. I mean, you can start to notice this as the mind gets more concentrated. You know, joy actually has an agitating feeling, and as we move deeper into our practice, we start to see that any kind of agitation has a stress to it. And so even joy, I mean, it is, you know, we don't think of joy as being stress, but there is a kind of a stress in there. Yeah. Thank you for that. And that actually fits very well in this kind of staged crossing, you know, that initially we're looking at dukkha as being the massive, you know, difficulties. At some point, we need to turn towards even, you know, the things that seem like they're supporting us. We have to actually turn our attention towards the states of mind that feel like they're supporting us. And notice these too are just arising and passing experiences. If we cling to joy, if we cling to happiness, we are going to suffer. So that's another way in which the joy and the beautiful aspects of practice are a kind of suffering, because they are also not inherently a place where we can land forever, because they do also change. And it's 11. So thank you for your attention.